to this episode of SAS Space Power Discussions. My name is Paul Elliott Stump. I'm in the United States Air Force.
Oh, Wood. You're going by your proper name today.
You can call me Wood.
Hey, Wood. I'm Steve Larson, United States Air Force. Go by Big Face.
And my name is Courtney Vitt. I go by Voodoo and United States Air Force. We have to get the disclaimer out of the way. So to begin, all opinions expressed here are our own and do not necessarily represent those of the Department of Defense, the Air Force, or any other affiliated organizations. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Voodoo. Yeah, this episode's part of a series of discussions that us and our classmates are going to be preparing in the spring of 2025, really focusing on space power and strategy here at the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies.
And today we're going to touch on our overall space power and overall SAS curriculum by reviewing the book Red Moon Rising, Sputnik and the Hidden Rivalries That Ignited the Space Age by Matthew Brzezinski.
Now, this was a great one. This book provides a deep dive into the early Soviet space program and how it fundamentally shaped the Cold War strategy, global perceptions of power, and the evolution of space in a strategic domain. Today, we'll be analyzing its key themes, the impacts on early Soviet space achievements, and, for all our strategists out there, strategic lessons we can apply in contemporary space power discussions.
Yeah, I think it's really important to note that, you know, the space race wasn't just a technological competition about getting something out in orbit. It was a critical component of what we were doing in the Cold War and part of our strategy. Understanding where it came from, which this book really dives into, especially the Soviet perspective, looking a lot at what Khrushchev was thinking, gives us some crucial insights in how space was and continues to be really contested in the domain of power and influence.
So, Wood, what were some of the things in the book that stood out to you, and what did you like?
You know, there was a lot of them. Personally, one of the big things that stuck out to me were the personalities and the timing that made this period really enjoyable to read about. You know, there was this secretive Soviet rocket guru named Sergei Korolev. They actually kept his name a complete state secret for years afterwards, even when he was, Nobel Prize was being awarded. They didn't award it to him. We've heard of the Secretary of Defense, Charlie Wilson, before, but they really dig into his background. You know, he was brought in by President Eisenhower to do a lot of budget cuts, which pertains a little bit to what's going on today. And there's some precedent here. And the new takes on a lot of these historical figures we've even met before. We've studied Nixon's actions in Vietnam, but this was a look at Nixon when he was the vice president. You know, didn't have the full confidence and the support of President Eisenhower at the time, as well as the Dulles brothers. John Foster Dulles was obviously huge into containment and countering Soviet influence as a sex state. But his brother's role, Alan Dulles, as the director of the CIA, you know, busy at the time in the early 50s with things like the U-2 and some of the initial development of SR-71.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more on the characters, Wood. You know, I thought the author did a very effective job of using these key characters for the Soviet Union and United States to kind of shape this picture on who was influencing the space race at the onset and at the individual and group level of decision making. Like, how did we end up in the position ultimately where we're at today, where it's, billions to trillions of dollars have gone into space architecture, and it all really started during this time period that we're going to be covering today?
Well, don't spoil it for our listeners. We have a whole podcast to record here, so let's walk through it and hit some of the highlights.
Okay, cool. So we'll start with a little bit of a summary of the book. The book opens up with the now famous Khrushchev speech, where he kind of speaks negatively against Stalin, who has passed away, and a lot of the policies and the way that he ran the Soviet Union. The Presidium, the legislative body on top of the Soviet Union, was pretty dumbfounded at it. And his secret speech didn't remain secret. You know, it got out pretty quickly. And that's important to note because it really set the stage for a lot of the internal issues that Khrushchev was going to have to deal with. A lot of times when we think about the space race, it's just, what is the Soviet Union doing to get to space and what is the United States doing? But there's all these internal domestic issues that are also having a large influence on the timelines associated with those.
And meanwhile, in the U.S. at that same time, hardline Republicans like Sexsted Dulles were open about their desire to prevent the spread of communism, really through rolling it back with the threat of massive retaliation in hopes of having a deterrent effect. One small problem, though, the Soviets didn't have the capability to even deliver a surprise nuclear attack, even though that's the discussion that was driving a significant amount of U.S. security concerns at the time.
Yeah, classic solution without a problem.
That's right. As we learn a little bit more about the development of Soviet missile technology, we're introduced to one of the main characters, Sergei Korolev. He was an engineer who had been rolled up under Stalin and sent to a prison camp for 10 years of hard labor. After Nazi Germany entered Russia in 1941, many of the banished engineers were brought back to work projects for the Soviet military. Fast forward then to the end of the war, and he was one of the lucky few sent to exploit German V-2 rockets. He would then develop copies and indigenous evolutions of the V-2 before completing the R-7, Russia's first long-range ICBM rocket that would be used to put up the world's first satellite.
Yeah, but this development wasn't just about prestige and building cool rockets, right? There was a pretty big economic impact to most of the war after World War II. The Western world was able to recover comparatively more quickly than the USSR thanks to the Marshall Plan.
That's right. Building these rockets was also about cost savings. While the U.S. was busy building thousands of bombers, Khrushchev was intentionally or unintentionally creating asymmetric advantage in the long-range nuclear weapon employment arena.
And that's the context where, you know, funny enough, space almost comes about as an accidental byproduct of some of these long-range nuclear weapons discussions, and particularly the missile development. Korolev, while he was showing the rockets to Soviet leaders, took an opportunity to also show them a developmental satellite. They weren't really interested, but the ICBM was unquestionably the Soviet Union's overriding priority. But the prospect of thumbing his nose at the Americans also had a certain undeniable appeal. If the main task doesn't suffer, do it. And then we make the jump over to America.
Now, I'm going to bring out another main character here, Charlie Wilson, larger-than-life character who had been previous head of General Motors. He was brought in by Ike to be SecDef and then helped him cost-cut some of the cost on the budget. Sounds familiar.
Yeah, in the first few weeks he came in, he cut 40,000 civilian jobs at the Pentagon. He also started to make his rounds and went to Redstone right up the road from here in Huntsville, Alabama. And he was going to visit the Army Ballistic Missile Agency. You'll hear us call it ABMA the rest of the podcast. During that visit, they were hoping that the ABMA leadership was hoping he was going to be looking at some of their emerging technology, but he became fixated on costs, unnecessary costs in his view, things like renovating guest houses and painting walls. So if we put this into perspective on a global scale, at a time when the U.S. is looking at how much money we're spending on renovating guest houses, Russia is putting all of its available resources into ICBM technology development.
Okay, I want to be clear here, Wood. The U.S. was behind in missile technology at this point. We didn't think we were, and many of louder voices didn't seem to care, but the U.S. was focused on jet power.
Air power.
Air power.
And that jet power was a pretty big indicator of the inter-service rivalry between the Army, Air Force, and the Navy that was continuing from the end of World War II. Specifically, the Army's need to fight for relevance, and the ABMA gave them an opportunity to do that if they were able to define the role of this new and emerging rocket technology. Meanwhile, LeMay and company were busy trying to get more and more funding for bombers and Strategic Air Command at a time when budgets were being looked at with a fine-tooth comb. That's why when reports started to come out of questionable reliability that Russia was building tons of long-range bombers, Army officials were skeptical. The timing just seemed too coincidental to the Air Force's narrative, and there was not a lot of supporting evidence or validated sources.
Yeah, but we loved us the bomber gap that we later learned was non-existent, but we loved it at the time. And Ike was kind of in a rough spot. You know, he couldn't look soft on national security during an election year. So he approved LeMay's request to build six more wings of strategic bombers, cool $1 billion, which is about $11 billion in today's money.
So while we're focused on building up our bomber forces to counter a supposed bomber gap, the USSR was plowing ahead.
Well, sort of. When Korolev showed the R-7 to Khrushchev, it was actually a mock-up, but he didn't tell him that. So now Korolev was under this self-imposed timeline, facing a ton of setbacks for technology he didn't have, and he was scared to communicate him.
And even in a post-Stalin era Soviet Russia, it's still not a place you want to tell your bosses you need more time or failed at a task of national importance. Hashtag to the gulag.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's right. But also, some of the reverberations from Khrushchev's de-Stalinization speech were starting to be felt in the outskirts of the Soviet bloc. You know, as the author puts it, the winds of democracy. Democracy wins. Were starting to spread, especially in Poland. You know, Poland was a central player for the Soviet Union in the newly formed Warsaw Pact, which was designed to counter NATO.
And also in Hungary, where protests were spreading to the point of requesting to separate from the USSR and requesting protection from the West. As we learned in some of the propaganda readings, the U.S.'s very own Radio for Europe, sponsored, shout out to them, and shout out to Osgood and Total Cold War, was growing increasingly insurrectionary.
So you kind of read this and you start to think, man, maybe there's some kinks inside the Soviet armor, right? But this was one of the first examples of those serendipitous timelines that Big Face mentioned in the open. The day after Khrushchev decided he needed to act with force to prevent the secession of Hungary, which was October 31st, Britain and France bombed Egypt over the nationalization of the Suez Canal. The U.S. was now stuck between a rock and a hard spot again. It would be hard to tell the world that we are going to condemn and go to support Hungary against Russian aggression when our allies were doing the same thing at that time.
All right, a few weeks after that, Ike Eisenhower gets reelected, and Charlie Wilson puts out a memo that the Army is officially frozen out of making missiles that go beyond 200 nautical miles. That gave the Air Force control over a mission that they didn't necessarily think was very important.
Yeah, I mean, when we think about it at the time, and still a little bit today, the majority of Air Force senior leaders are pilots. And at this time frame, post-World War II, bombers were all the hotness. So they'd been given a mission they didn't really feel was valuable. One of the quotes that the book highlights is, how do you show teeth with missiles? And reading it, it kind of made me feel like this missile prioritization, this initial shift over to the Air Force, was kind of dead on arrival.
This is where it gets kind of cool. Walt Disney was starting to show a focus on some of the common attractions he would have in his new Walt Disney World. One of them was Tomorrowland. All you parents out there, even kids growing up, know Tomorrowland and know how futuristic it is. Look at the new technologies. His futuristic concepts captured the imagination of Americans. He would go on to bring Wernher von Braun, a Nazi scientist that had been brought back to the U.S. to help out with the missile program. Although some say it was simply to prevent others from getting his knowledge for their own use, Wernher von Braun and Walt Disney had the perfect partnership. One dreamed of reaching the stars while the other made sure they were animated.
Oh, that's cute. There's also at this time the International Geophysical Year, which we'll call IGGY from now on. This comes into the picture as a sort of science Olympics that happens once every 50 years to encourage scientists around the world to push new exploration and innovative development. The U.S. and the Soviets got a little bit ahead of themselves, but both said, we are going to enter the IGGY and we are going to send up satellites to measure different things in space.
Yeah, but both nations really were just looking for an excuse in a non-military context to test out their military hardware under friendly auspices. We read a book earlier in the Space Power course, Original Sin by Bowen, that really hammers home the point that space was not developed at the outset for the good of humanity. Space has always had this underlying connection back to military capabilities.
Even then, the U.S. wasn't spending a lot of money on it compared to the Soviets. In an almost prophetic message, Nelson Rockefeller sent a memo to Ike stating the following.
Ike, the stake of the prestige is involved here. It makes the space race one we cannot afford to lose. The unmistakable relationship in ICBM technology, well, it might have important repercussions in the political determination of the free world countries to resist communist threats.
Man, Wood, I can't believe you were able to find the actual audio recording.
That's amazing.
Of that Rockefeller message in his own voice.
Very rare. The archives here at AU are incredible.
You know, here's the prestige concept again.
Worldwide.
That's great.
We've talked about this multiple times throughout the course, that the power of prestige in diplomacy and in policymaking actually is underrepresented in some of the literature, but it actually plays a critical role in some of the decisions that are made going forward.
And as we jump back to the USSR, it is now time to test the R-7 out of its secret facility in Kazakhstan. Like most first rocket tests, it launched but failed. And although it failed, Korolev was excited to see the progress, take away the lessons learned for future lessons, and continue building towards his goal of integrating these rocket and satellite technologies.
Isn't that the kind of thing that you can get disappeared on with the Soviets?
Definitely under Stalin, and I'd say a solid maybe under Khrushchev. And especially by this point in time, when Khrushchev was so enamored with this ballistic missile technology, and you had other external events that were happening to shape the space race elsewhere.
Like another protest?
Technically, yes. More of a full-fledged coup at the Presidium, I'd say. The members were tired of Khrushchev, tired of his economic policies, his anti-Stalinist rhetoric. Khrushchev was actually voted out of the Presidium.
Big Face, we've read a lot of books this year and scammed even more. And I don't remember anything about Khrushchev being kicked out in 1957.
Yeah, me neither.
Voted out doesn't mean he ever actually stepped down. In fact, because of his close ties to key military figures in the Soviet Army and the head of the KGB, he was able to stop the coup really before it even started, within the first 48 hours.
Well, this seems pretty chaotic, but where is the rocket development at this point in time while there's this coup going on?
While our boy Korolev was still testing, the final R-7 launch was mostly a success. The nose cone, to disintegrated on reentry.
That's not good.
Kind of an important piece for an ICBM carrying a nuclear weapon to a target. Man, Korolev's team was burnt out. It was over 130 degrees in the Kazakhstan desert. They needed time to solve this nose cone problem. And to buy some time, he told his crews that while they were working on the nose cone issue, they were going to launch some satellites. And that would be enough to distract Khrushchev from his attention on the ICBM project.
Comrades, while we work on it.
I'm just kidding. And while all this was happening, the U.S. had super low intelligence fidelity on the latest and greatest Soviet developments. We didn't even have maps that showed all the cities and all the roads. We had very limited human collection capability, but in comes the U2.
The band?
Yeah. Hello.
And even U2 wasn't enough to stop. even the band, U2, was not enough to stop General LeMay.
After his first flight into Soviet territory on July 4th, 1956, we knew that the bomber gap was a lie.
And even after figuring that out, it still wasn't enough to stop the SAC expansion. Why not?
Because it would have exposed the existence of new intelligence and the U2.
Still not the band.
The director of the CIA covert operations, Richard Bissell, knew our ability to overfly Russia was short-term gain. So he wanted to maximize the window of opportunity. He was also pleading with the assistant SecDef at the time to take Iggy's satellite concept more seriously. But there was a problem.
Well, I'm going to guess that it had to do with either A, a Nazi scientist, B, an animated mouse, or C, the Army Ballistic Missile Defense Program.
No. It was space law. CIA attorneys had no idea who had the territorial rights to outer space. Did sovereign airspace expand beyond the stratosphere? There was no legal precedent for a satellite going around the globe at this time.
And if you look at another recent book we've read, The Space Law Stalemate, the author takes the position that the international space law regime has really been locked in a 40-plus year stalemate, largely stemming from some of this rapid technological onset during the space age. And from a Russian perspective and a U.S. great power perspective, not factoring in the concerns of other non-spacefaring nations, maybe it was in our best interest to not pursue additional laws and restraints on that technological growth.
Yeah, I think that was actually one of the critiques of the book. And maybe there wasn't a lot of external influence or opinions being formed on it. I get it. There was two superpowers trying to go to space. But the inability to include some of our partners and allies on the way forward and the shaping decisions we had then is probably what contributed to that 40-year stalemate we have now.
Yeah, but you know, the Soviets weren't really hamstrung by legalese. Although the nose cone problem from the first R-7 launch hadn't been solved, they were still primed to get something into space, but it wasn't going to be a half-ton satellite with cool scientific payloads. It was going to be a 22-inch spear with a couple of antennas.
What? That's a... So if a basketball's 9 inches, 20... Sounds pretty unimpressive.
Or impressive. It was the concept more than the effect. All he needed was Khrushchev to buy in. And once he did, a launch date was set for October 6, 1957.
Then the Sputnik was launched on October 4th, if I'm not mistaken. What happened with that?
Well, it turns out our boy Korolev was a little bit paranoid. There were some misinterpretations of things in the media about the U.S. putting a satellite into space. It was actually just going to be a speech on the concept, but he believed that there was indications the U.S. might actually be putting a satellite into space before they were able to do so in just a week. So he went to the KGB and said, hey, find out if this is actually happening. They came back and said no. And he said, well, I don't care. I still want to put something up quicker, so let's move the launch day up 2 days.
And that wasn't the only place in the world that a lot was happening that day. Our man Injun Charlie had quit his role as the Secretary of Defense and gone back to the corporate world. And our newly nominated but not yet approved SecDef, Neil McElroy, was in Huntsville visiting the ABMA. And the ABMA saw that as a new opportunity to maybe breathe some life back into the prioritization of their rocket and missile programs.
Yeah.
While having a few cocktails, an aide came in and announced that the Soviets had been successful in orbiting a transmitting satellite.
What a coincidence. At the same time the SecDef is visiting our scientist, Wernher von Braun, the Soviets are also achieving spaceflight.
And again, touching one more time on the whole inter-service rivalry element of this in the United States, General Medaris, the commander at the ABMA at that time, made the comment that he wasn't even considering a competition with the Soviet Unions. He had considered his role the entire time at the ABMA an inter-service competition between the Army, Navy, and the Air Force. So that really added to the element of surprise. And the author makes a great point, saying that science thrives under totalitarian regimes, even if free speech and commerce do not. Although people were starving and many struggled to find adequate housing, the government structure in Russia enabled a lot of room for scientific innovation, provided it was in the best interest of the government.
Yeah, and I bet while this is happening, Eisenhower is getting pretty upset. What was his reaction?
Not thrilled, but he was also getting pretty burnt out. Civil rights chaos at home, including the recent challenges in Little Rock, a heart attack, stomach surgery. Eisenhower was at the farm taking a break, trying to recover and play a little bit of golf. This is where usually a vice president would step in, but in fact, Dulles is the one who stepped in to make a formal press statement about it.
Yeah, and that was the time when we were trying to really downplay it, right? Like the Soviets had, in fact, beat us to space, and we wanted to downplay it in the public so the public wouldn't freak out, and we could also kind of marginalize their achievement. We tried to logic our way out, saying things like, well, it must have been the Germans who actually used Russian equipment to launch German capabilities into space. And we even downplayed the actual satellite, saying it wasn't a big deal.
And behind closed doors, we were trying to rationalize and find a silver lining, trying to push narratives like the Russians have in fact done us a good turn unintentionally in establishing the concept of freedom of international space. But President Eisenhower wasn't having it.
Yeah, but when the government tries to downplay or ignore something, it usually gets made into a much bigger deal. Hashtag Streisand effect. Speaking of narratives, press called it a great national emergency, a grave defeat, technological Pearl Harbor, chilling beeps in vital sectors of tech race. The U.S. may have well lost its precious lead. Finally, I came out and called it one small ball, which initially reassured the press, but it started to blow up the next day.
I mean, you nailed it. Khrushchev realized after the fact that it was a huge propaganda win for the Soviets. Cuts to the Navy, Army, and bomber fleet seemed worth it. So that risk that Khrushchev had been willing to take seemed like was starting to pay off for the Soviets.
Yeah, except it started to kind of double down hurt on us when our allies started to question our dominance in technology. You know, even Mexico, just to the south of us, started to request Soviet scientific experience and Soviet scientific help instead of relying on the U.S.
But Khrushchev wasn't done yet. With Mao Zedong visiting soon, he wanted to show off. So in classic Cold War fashion, they strapped a dog to a rocket. It was an ultimate astronaut.
There it is. It's Bunny.
Took one for the team, became the first living creature in orbit, although poor puppy didn't last long. No pressure, though, just impressing the entire communist bloc.
And that was another huge propaganda win for the Soviets. Cuddly Soviet space dog captured hearts and minds worldwide. Even if the mission was a one-way mission, propaganda greater than payload.
You know, meanwhile, back in the U.S., we didn't have a dog going into space, but things were still looking pretty rough.
Oh, good one.
The press was hyping up this missile gap, comparing it to the bomber gap that we now knew was non-existent, and Congress was panicking. Eisenhower was still trying to play it cool, but it was a little bit too cool.
And on the technical side, the U.S. response was also a bit of a mess. The Vanguard program, which had been championed by the Navy as part of those inter-service rivalry priorities, collapsed very publicly in a very infamous launch where the rocket barely got off the pad before exploding. Mm. It was literally a fireworks show for the Soviets.
Which triggered a total PR meltdown. The media called it Kaputnik or Flopnik. Even the Allies were wondering if we'd totally lost the plot. Confidence in America tech was shaken hard.
Yeah, and contributing to that was this contracting fragmentation that I think we can still see a little bit today, where different pieces of the satellite launch vehicle were handed out to different contractors. This led to a lot of integration problems. Classic case of too many cooks and not enough space launches.
This is when Eisenhower finally gave the green light to Wernher von Braun and his team. They'd been sitting on the bench largely for political reasons, but the political motivations were now finally high enough where it was time to get them in the game as the U.S.'s best hope to save face.
After a string of failures, January 31st, 1958, finally brings us some good news. The Army, along with von Braun at the helm, launches Explorer 1 into orbit. America is officially in the space game.
Well, and it wasn't just a symbolic win. You know, Explorer 1 did discover some cool stuff, like the Van Allen radiation belts, which space conspiracy theorists use to justify the fact that they say we didn't go to the moon, proving that the U.S. could still punch above its weight class.
Yeah, and this wasn't just playing catch-up. These were real scientific contributions. The Goldstone tracking station in California gets the ping, the bird is flying, and America can breathe a collective sigh of relief.
You know, something also that's really interesting and really pretty cool about this was it also laid the groundwork for the creation of NASA. The military-run chaos gave way to centralized civilian space agency, which, in hindsight, was a smart move for managing the balance between national prestige There it is again, an actionable technological progress.
Yeah, Brzezinski closes the book on a little bit of a reflective note. You know, as we've kind of talked about here throughout this summary and this review of the book, the Sputnik really changed everything. Defense budgets, school curriculums, what each service valued. It showed how a small metal ball, as Ike put it, could shift the entire global balance of power.
And what really stands out to me is that none of this started for the sake of space exploration. The space race was born out of fear, rivalry, the need for the U.S. and the Soviet Union to find some sort of Cold War advantage against each other. All of that romanticism really came after the militarism that kicked this whole thing off.
I also really liked how the book subtly made the point that authoritarian regimes, for all their flaws, could channel national will into scientific achievement if the right people were in charge. Korolev wasn't just the rocket guy. He was also the guy who made rockets happen, despite the system around him.
Right, and the U.S. response, while pretty clunky at first, admittedly, was actually built on a more sustainable path. Sputnik sparked a reimagining of our priorities and the imagination of our youth, the education, research and development, and yes, even space law.
Oh, space law, you know I love it.
It's almost poetic when you think about it. One beep from a satellite turned into a thunderclap that echoed through global strategy, culture, and policy for decades.
And, well, on that clap, that's a wrap on Red Moon Rising. From dog launches to exploding rockets to a race fueled by prestige and paranoia, this was the origin story of space power as we know it. Any closing comments, guys?
Yeah, I thought that and this isn't just a play on the recent book with the little recency bias we have, but I thought the idea juxtaposing how we were worried and consumed with the idea of legal norms and standards that we were going to put in space with space law, while the Russians were just hauling it. How quickly can we get there? We'll worry about the rest of it later. And it kind of initially you'd say, well, that slowed you down. That slowed down the United States in getting there. But when I talked about it earlier, it actually created a more sustainable path. We let them break the norm. We go in and establish the norm. And now we get to set the standards for their national community.
You know, I think it's interesting as we go back to some of the military-focused space theories that we've reviewed in this course, you still see those analogies and elements of the other, I'd say, more conventional military domains. So from the U.S. perspective, it feels like we're still trying to find a way to make space align with naval strategy or with air operations. And that seemed to have been a motivating factor at the onset.
All great points. Well, thank you for joining us today on SAS Space Power Discussions. This is Class 34, Voodoo, Wood, and Big Face signing off. Have yourself a lovely strategy day.